welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fantastic film called The Fighting Bell. I got so many questions about where it was filmed, what happened, what's going on, where did he find this fun cast, and he has a lot of people. So Sean Riley, tell me about your film.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me on, Simon. So Fighting Bell, I like to say, I guess my sales pitch is that it's Legally Blonde meets Rocky. It's about a sassy Southern belle who gets jilted at the altar by her fighter fiancé. So she decides to get even by putting on the gloves and getting her revenge against him.
I don't know if she gets there immediately, does she? She takes some time to get there.
Yeah, you know, she that's her kind of immediate goal is to get even. But along the way, she sort of realizes that's not so important anymore. But of course, at the end, she is kind of made to square off anyway. So
she is. So let's start off the beginning. Beginning of the film, you have some really nice rock music, and it's throughout the film. I found I made numerous notes about rock music constantly. So
yeah, we were very fortunate to have some really really nice musical guests contribute to the soundtrack. And now I'm going to be put on the spot, and I can't remember the names of the acts. But as we go along, I'm going to see if I can't remember here now that I'm on the spot.
Sorry about that, because you start off with a really good rock song over the credits right off the beginning. I'm like, okay, now I know what this film is. Trying to play like Rocky, all right, right off the beginning.
Well, I want to say, actually, the Glenn Chandler Project is one artist that contributed pretty heavily to the soundtrack, and he's out of Jacksonville, Florida. So that's probably one that you're thinking of at this moment.
Okay, I didn't write down the musical. I just know his name. I mean, you have a huge cast. Like, your opening scene is massive.
Yeah, that was one of the challenges. You know, of course, this is a micro budget film, and that was one of the big obstacles for filming this, was the cast was so large. But at the end of the day, you know, I knew I had a great script in hand, and I just had to move forward, even though that was a major concern. And fortunately, it didn't come back and bite me on the rear. But yeah, the wedding scenes and, you know, slash the fight scenes and that sort of thing, it was challenging to make sure that we had enough extras and all of our cast on hand to film.
Now, I'm going to have to ask, when you shot the wedding scene right off the beginning and the end of the movie takes place in the same place, are they filmed the same day or for similar times, or did you film in order, or how did you do it?
Well, and let me say this first while I'm thinking about this. Jonathan Robbins was the other possibly rock artist that you might have been thinking of besides Glenn Chandler. So I don't want to leave his contributions out. Jonathan Robbins is an amazing, amazing artist. So I want to give him his props. But in regard to the shooting, the original idea, yeah, was that, you know, we would have all of those extras on hand. So we would like to go ahead and schedule the wedding scene and then move into the fight scene the same day, but it didn't quite work out that way. I should take that back. I think the original idea was to shoot them the same weekend. The idea was to shoot the wedding scene and the charity ball scene in the same day, which we did. But what happened was, well, at least the story that was relayed to me was that one of the extras told all the other extras that shooting was over for the day. And so everyone left except for a handful of our background actors. And we're about to give up and call it a night. And there were a few holdouts, and we gathered them together, and we kind of squared off a piece of the big hall at the location that we were shooting at. And fortunately, we were able to troop through and get that charity event scene in the camp. But it was such a scaled down version from what it was supposed to be in the script. But fortunately, the audience doesn't know that, and I think we pulled off that scene. But it was going to be a much, much bigger deal in the film had we shot it according to the script.
I don't want to nitpick you, but I did notice you were missing a lot of people in the charity scene. If you had edited it down, right, because you do a really close-up shot of the couples dancing.
Right.
And just before you show that, you pan to the right, and there's nobody there.
Well, see, you're not supposed to notice that.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I totally noticed. I'm like, what happened to all the extras? And I totally noticed that pan to the right shot. I'm like, okay, I'll let it go. It's indie cinema. I didn't know. I'm just like, you brought it up. I'm like, I did notice.
Fortunately, a lot of people didn't, but in the script, it was, yeah, we were going to have couples waltzing and this whole thing. And, you know, there's really two parts to the scene. It's the, you know, the two main characters kind of coming together romantically. And then the second part, which is the reintroduction of the antagonist character and the surprise reveal of another one of the minor characters in the scene. And then that played out, but it was much, much longer scene, but, I'm just glad that we got it shot and in the can, and really that exceeded my expectations because I thought we were ruined for the night. So
now, so you shot the wedding scene off the beginning and then you switched to the charity scene next?
We did. We took a little break from the initial wedding scene. We, you know, had lunch, regrouped, you know, an hour or so later and then shot the rest. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is insane because you really shouldn't do that. That wedding scene should have taken 2 or 3 days to film by itself.
Yeah, so I would think so. That was a big scene. And
we were doing some.
Go ahead.
We were doing some pretty insane things as far as the shooting schedule. Really pushing things to get shot because you know the house, the beautiful house that we shot in, which was where most of the interior scenes come from, the home scenes, the wedding scenes, the charity event scenes, was all in the same house. And, you know, the house was like $400 a night to rent. So we were really pushing to get as much done as we can. And, yeah, you know, we'd hear the actors kind of walk around saying, aren't we supposed to shoot 6 pages a day or something like that? And we were shooting like 10 and 11 pages a day. So it was really insane to do that. But fortunately, my production team didn't ask a question or bat an eye about it, and so we just pushed forward and we got it done.
I have a note here. It looks like a big house. How big is this place? It's massive.
Well, you know, it's called Oakcrest Mansion Inn, so that will give you an idea. It is a mansion. You know, it's a really old, I don't know if it's antebellum, but it's a pretty old house. Supposedly Elvis spent a few nights there. But it's, yeah, large enough to provide that many different locations in the film. You know, every interior shot there, I believe, except for the boxing training scenes and the boutique scenes. So.
Oh, so the boutique scene's not at that house yet.
No, those were in another city actually called Ocean Springs, and the mansion was actually in a city called Pass Christiane, which they're all located on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, but yeah, two separate locations.
I'm going to ask you a weird question. What state are we in?
Mississippi.
Thank you. So I'm Canadian, so you're kind of throwing me off a bit.
No problem. I'm assuming again, so.
Yeah, no problem. What was up? I have a note here. I really enjoyed the costume design. I thought it all worked. Now, was the wardrobe brought by the people, or did you pick it out, or how did that work?
It really depends on which scene you're talking about. Some of it, my wife and I put together. Some of it, you know, the actors brought themselves. Some of it was the product of some debate back and forth between the cast. So it depends on what you're thinking about, really.
Okay. Well, one of my questions is Delilah's sister. What's up with the hat?
That was, okay. So that was her idea. The character of Charlene is kind of the black sheep of the family. So Mallory Hines was like, well, what do you think about this top cast? You know, she's trying to make the wedding all about herself. And I was like, that's pretty cool. We can go with that. And so we did.
Okay. I was just wondering, like, okay, I got to ask about the hat because it stands out. Is that was your point? It does. No issues.
Completely an actor choice.
And she didn't connect on the altar. How did she miss her punch?
Well, you know, Kelvin is a trained boxer, and so he's got the bobbing and weaving and the evasive moves. So, you know, Delilah at that point is not exactly a trained fighter, so pretty easy for him to dodge her punches.
Okay, and the mother says to Delilah, who spends $5,000 on a wedding cake? That kind of threw me off.
Well, you know, this is if you're familiar with the South and the United States, you know, it's a very about the spectacle.
Okay.
You know, events like weddings and things, and so you know, this being an upper class family, you know, they wouldn't have batted an eye about spending that kind of money on a wedding cake and all that sort of thing. So.
So I do make notes like this. These are my notes as we go through.
Those are good notes.
Yeah. How did your casting work? Like, where did you find Delilah? Where did you find the sister? And the minister. I need to know where you found the minister.
Well, okay, so Delilah, she was one of the toughest roles to cast because everything depends on her casting, you know, who you get as the leading man and the family and that sort of thing. And I had a lot of trouble casting that role. At one point, we had another actor cast. She's actually a singer as well. But she was a union actor, and we decided to go non-union because of financing and things. So I was really about to give up, you know, and move on to another project. But at the end of the casting process, I kind of, for some reason, I had this mutual Facebook friend in Jessica Hearthcock. I didn't know her. I'd never talked to her. She was just kind of on the periphery of my Mississippi, you know, filmmaking friends. And so I said, what the heck? She kind of, you know, she's blonde and, you know, young and, you know, just give it a shot. And I kind of sent her some information around midnight one night. That's how, you know, how deep in despair I was. And the next morning she had, you know, in my email box was an audition waiting for me, and she completely blew it away. And I showed my wife and we were just like, that's her. We got her. So we were very lucky to find her. As far as, the minister, he was actually he may have been one of the first, actors that we cast in the film. And I think I found his reel online, through backstage.com or something like that. And he was very raw actor. It was a kind of a homemade iPhone shot reel that he put together. But I was just like, my gosh, this is the minister right here. He would bring so much comic appeal to the role. And when he sent in his audition for the film, it was just like, people are going to find him hysterical. So, that's, G. Tremaine, Morrell. And then the other actor, who was the third one that you had asked about?
The sister?
Mallory.
Yes.
Yeah, Mallory was kind of an unorthodox decision for that role. And I believe I might have found her through Backstage. And I'm trying to be careful not to say Backpage, because that's going to get us into a whole different ball of worms here that we don't want to get into. But anyway, so she was kind of not too far away. And in the script, Charlene is written sort of as – you know, a heavy set character. The running joke with her is that she's always eating in every scene. I don't know if you noticed that in the film, but she always has food with her.
Yeah.
In some form or fashion.
I did, I was kind of like,
Yeah, and I didn't want, I thought that was a little bit too easy and also a little bit mean spirited to cast, you know, a heavier actor in that role. And I thought that might be sort of a way to make that role a little bit more interesting, is to cast someone unorthodox who doesn't have that Southern Belle look, who's, you know, kind of the black sheep of the family. And I saw Mallory's her reel, and I thought, you know, she's a pretty interesting choice and not somebody you would first think of. And of course, that makes her even more interesting for a role like that.
So you had a lot of work to do, it sounds like, in order to casting. So you had nothing picked out ahead of time for anybody.
Well, you know, I think I did a fair amount of casting, probably unorthodoxly, if that's a word. Because a lot of the casting that I did was before we had even raised any of the financing. And it's a testament to the actors that they were, you know, that they were willing to go along with that and engage in a conversation with me when we really didn't have many of the pieces set up and ready to go. So I think I actually did a fair amount of casting, before financing and things. So more than you probably would see on a typical film.
I do want to go into how you got your funding, but I do have a couple more questions just on locations. Where did you find the boxing arena? Was that easy to get? Because that's not something really easy to find, I would think.
Yeah, surprisingly, that was one of the pieces that was easier to find, you know, as luck would have it. And that was one of the reasons why I decided. You know, I had owned the option rights to Fighting Bell for a number of years. We had spent a long time trying to get the film made in central Mississippi. And I moved kind of in a roundabout way. I moved to the coast of Mississippi. And it just so happened that they had all these location pieces available. You know, they had the Southern Mansion. They had the boxing ring. Because some, you know, we have kind of the very picturesque Southern town locations down here. But we also have some grittier urban areas. And as luck would have it, in Gulfport, Mississippi, we had a legit boxing gym. And that's, you know, that's really not a location you can create. I mean, that's a real boxing gym with sweat and, you know, and that's, you know, we were told we probably didn't want to go film down there, and definitely not want to film down there during the evenings. But we didn't have any trouble down there. But yeah, that's a real boxing gym.
Now, was the gym open all the time, or did you film at night, or how did you get into that?
We filmed on the weekends. They do their training during the week, and then they go do their boxing bouts during the weekends. So fortunately, we had open access, and it's a city owned location. So we were able to use it for next to nothing. I think as part of our our Indiegogo fundraiser, we donated a portion of our proceeds to their boxing organization. But the owner was super welcoming and wanted to see boxing promoted, especially Mississippi boxing. And so we were really lucky to have someone let us come in there and use those facilities.
And we got to discuss the boutique.
Okay.
I have a note here. I put it, Delilah now works at a secondhand store. Is it a secondhand boutique, or is it new stuff?
It's new stuff, even though you don't really see too much of the clothing, but it's a nice boutique. It's a boutique called Charisma. It is located in downtown Ocean Springs, which is one of the more prestigious areas of the city.
I saw that storefront, Charisma, when her friends come in. You do a shot on the street and walk them in.
Correct. It is a real boutique, and it's first class stuff, and so yeah.
So now I'm in trouble when they listen to this because I couldn't tell.
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to appreciate it. But at the same time, I realized that I don't think very much of the clothing was featured in the film. We're primarily shooting behind the counter at the wall. So I think you'd be forgiven for making that assumption.
Well, that's good. I did like your use of the customer with the perfume.
Yeah, that was Beverly, and I hope she goes by Corpier still. Anyway, she was I think we went through – that was one of our only roles that we actually reached out to a local casting company because we were finding some difficulty to find some of these – fill some of these minor speaking roles with characters. And I wanted someone that was really colorful because Delilah's so colorful. You have to find someone who can kind of match her. Her energy, and we were sent Beverly, and she did an awesome job. She's very memorable in that role.
Oh, she made me laugh a couple of times. I liked her a lot. I thought Beverly was good. No, I just
yeah.
She has very good timing, Beverly. I thought she was probably she looked like a real actress to me. On the
yeah, you know,
she seemed to get it.
We have so much footage that didn't wind up in those scenes where we would just let the camera run, and she would do her thing, and we would just she would come up with all this stuff. This crazy stuff to do on the spur of the moment. And we just used, we found portions to use in the film. But there's so much more that you didn't see. And she just like, once you roll a camera, she just didn't stop. So it's pretty, pretty amazing stuff.
Now, how did you get the use of that location?
Well, that was actually one of the harder locations to find, believe it or not. I kind of went, traversed downtown Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and, I went to some of the boutiques that looked, what I thought sort of looked Southern, and, some of them were like, you want to shoot a movie in here? What are you talking about, And quite a few would not get back with us for whatever reason, and that was one that I went into, and the owner just happened to be in there, and she was just like, yeah, come on in. And, well, actually, first she was like, how much is this going to cost me? And I had to laugh. I'm like, you don't know how this works, do you? So I was like, look, there's no cost to you. We're just, indebted to you for allowing us to shoot there. And she's like, oh, okay, cool. So we came and shot. Fortunately, it only took a day to shoot all of the boutique scenes because I think by the end of the shooting, she was kind of over it. And she was kind of like jaded by the whole filmmaking experience. And I guess you know how tedious and boring it can be, but we were able to get everything in one day, fortunately, so we weren't able to bother her or, didn't have to bother her anymore about that.
Well, that's nice of you. How does your Indiegogo campaign work? What was your setup like? How did that work out for you?
It was a pretty big learning curve because I had never done anything like that before, and so I would listen to podcasts and things, Indie Hustle, and all kind of, to get ideas about, things you should do and shouldn't, and My whole setup, my technical setup, my computer, and was so poor that I kind of cobbled together a little campaign, and finally put something out there. And I'd say probably 2/3 of those who contributed were family and friends, which you would expect. But actually close to 1/3 of the people were strangers who just found the campaign online and wanted to contribute, which was cool because as a micro-budget romantic comedy, that's not really what those platforms are set up for. It's more of like, the horror and the special interests that already have, the fan base, your mystery science theater type things. So I was really pleased that some people stepped up, and I kind of consider them friends now, because through the whole contributing process, we kind of, they feel ownership in the film, and I think we speak on a personal level now. So that's pretty cool.
That's awesome. So I'm sorry I didn't read your campaign. Did you send out DVDs, or was it straight screeners to digital, or what were your fundraising goals as you got to the levels?
Well, you don't want to set it too high because you want to reach your goal, because that allows you to extend your campaign indefinitely. So I had to set a modest goal that. Really, I thought that it would be enough, maybe enough to let us film a few scenes. Maybe we could put together, some kind of little pitch reel or something. But, when we met our goal and then some, I was kind of like, well, let's just kind of start shooting and then let's see how far we can get. And, we offered, DVDs, of course, digital downloads, producer credits on the film, of course, your name on poster art, things like that. So, that sort of thing. And as we went along, we offered some other things like a vanity credit above the title, which you probably have seen. Vince Mack, his name is above the title.
Well, that's great. I mean, I think you did a great job. Now, I'm going to go back to the phone for a bit because I have some more questions, obviously. It took me a few minutes to notice the sash kept changing. It did. At first, I'm like, that sash change. And then I started noticing it. I started really paying attention to the constant changing sashes. Now, was that in the script or was that something you added?
That was an after the fact kind of thing that I thought would be a funny joke. Yeah, and that was provided by, I hope I get this right, Banners Plus, I believe the name of the company is, with Lisa. And I'm going to mispronounce her name, but anyway, I reached out to a few sash making companies, and of course I didn't know anything, and that was probably my biggest asset was not knowing anything. And one of the companies I reached out to was the lady who does the actual Miss America pageant sashes, or maybe it's Miss Universe. Here I am. I'm thinking, hey, how would you like for us to feature your sashes in the film? And that's some good publicity for you and things. And so she fires back this email, pretty much putting me in check and letting me know that, darling, I am the premier sash maker in America. My sashes are worn by Miss America pageants or whatnot, and I don't need the publicity. Thank you very much. And so I kind of put my tail between my legs and went to another outlet. And fortunately I met Lisa, and she was like, we would kick around ideas, and she wanted to go way more extreme than I did. But we kind of collaborated on ideas, and she was like, gave us all the sashes for free. And so she was really awesome about that.
Oh, it made me laugh. The other female boxer looks really tough.
Yeah, that's Donnie Pierre, and the funny thing about her is that she is probably the exact opposite of her character. She is very meek and soft-spoken.
You're kidding
me. Yeah.
There's no way. She did a good job then.
Yeah, that is the opposite of her personality. She's very, very quiet. When we did have our opening screening at a theater, and she was there for the Q&A, it was funny to kind of see the audience see her true personality on stage and her speak and everything, because she is so different from her character.
Oh, wow. I've been shocked. How come she's not wearing a sash in the boxing scenes?
Delilah. Well, she does wear a sash in a fair amount of the boxing scenes.
In the beginning, but when she gets in the ring, it's off finally. When she takes it seriously, she gives it up.
Well, that was the idea. We thought that, the boxing gym is kind of her transition point. I really envisioned the characters as all being on some point of the spectrum, and Delilah is on one end, and Kelvin is on the other. And as Delilah, you know, meets this cast of misfits at the boxing gym, and kind of starts to merge her two worlds, the pageant world becomes less important, and the boxing world takes on a little bit more importance for her.
But I don't know. Can you say the pageant world left her behind? Because she's still wearing the sashes constantly. So I would say she didn't leave it behind. She understands it still exists, but she's moved on.
Right. And as you, you know, as the movie progresses, you'll notice that you see the sash less and less prominently, and until by the end of the film, she doesn't wear the sash at all when she fights Kelvin. In fact, she's given a kind of gift sash by Charlene at the end.
She is.
As a reminder, but you know, from the wedding where she wears the original sash was her wedding gown to the final fight where she is sashless, you know, there's that kind of dichotomy between those two worlds and her growth from the beginning of the film to the end.
Where did the idea for the boxing waltz come from?
Oh, let's see. I think that was in the script as a way that Tandy was able to make a contribution to Delilah, where, you know, he takes this part of her world and he kind of uses it as a way to, you know, something that she knows about that he can work into her fighting style. And we kind of decided to play that up because it was a good idea. You know, the seeds were there for a good idea. And so we decided to highlight that to give her kind of a finishing move that, you know, because the whole problem with you know, fighting Kelvin, of course, is that, you know, people would say, well, it's not real. We would hear that all the time. It's not realistic that she could hang with somebody like Kelvin. But, you know, if she does some unorthodox things that a fighter wouldn't expect, like, you know, building a waltz into her fighting style, that actually might be a little bit more realistic and something that audiences could swallow.
But my argument is, did Kelvin even take her seriously?
Yeah, I don't think that he ever does, and I think that's what catches him off guard.
He's not really training, so he loses. I hate to ruin it, but because he didn't take her seriously.
Yeah, and I don't think audiences would be surprised to sort of figure out what's going to happen here. It, you know, the whole thing is give the audience what they expect in an unexpected way, and I think that we do that. I think that's kind of his downfall, that he is so arrogant and he doesn't expect her to actually, you know, prove any sort of challenge.
Yeah, I think she does a great job. Now, my favorite question is, how did you feed your extras, feed your cast? How did that work?
Yeah, that would be one of our biggest budget line items was feeding cast and crew, and so we did different takeout at different points, but toward the end of the production run, we were really low on funds, so we started hitting like Little Caesars pizza and things, just like mass produced pizza to save money, but unfortunately, we weren't able to feed extras, so we really tried to be respectful and short with their time to get them in and get them out, and they were really accommodating and really, really good about that. So, but yeah, that was a really big line item that, probably one of our bigger line items on the film.
How long did you shoot for?
When I look back, I believe it was about 9 days, and I wouldn't even say 9 full days, but it was approximately 9 days, which is pretty insane.
That's a quick shoot. That is really fast.
Unfortunately, that was out of necessity because, you know, our funds were so low. We had to get so much done, you know, and matter of fact, you know, I like to say we shot everything that we had to shoot, but we didn't unfortunately shoot everything on script. I already mentioned some of the scenes were pared down a little bit from the original concept, but we actually, two or three scenes wound up on the production floor, not getting shot, unfortunately. But I'm kind of amazed at what we did accomplish.
Is this your first film, or do you have other films besides this one?
First feature film, I believe it was my fifth short film, but definitely nothing in scope compared to this one.
So what did you learn? I mean, your shorts are usually about 15 minutes, maybe five. I mean, you got some options. How did it feel to shoot a 2-hour film?
Well, my last short, funny enough, was about 20 minutes, and which isn't so much of a short, but it still technically qualifies as a short. And I cannot make a short film because that is an art form in itself to, you know, to to pull off what a short film should be. They're not really equipped to be three-act projects, and that's what I always try to do. And so I always get myself into trouble with these, like, epic short films. So I'm just not a good short filmmaker. But one thing that it did teach me, which was very important, especially for part-time micro-budget filmmakers, is the notion that a feature film really could be seen as a collection of short films. And so, you know, I shot my last short film in a weekend. And so I was like, well, you know, I have a day job. I'm a school administrator and as a full-time job. So what if I kind of shot one or two weekends a month and kind of prepped them and planned them like there were many short films? And by the end of it, I would have a completed feature film. And that's what I did.
Uh-huh. Very smart of you.
That's yeah, good. Bite-sized chunks. It's really intimidating, and I don't know if I could have done it shooting straight days, you know, with all the planning that's required. And really, I had such a skeleton crew of people who would help, you know, plan and organize the different weekend shoots that if I had to do it 9 straight days, I don't think I could have done it.
Did you own your equipment or did you rent your equipment?
Equipment was owned by the production company that I worked with on the film.
Okay, I think that's it. Unless you got something I've missed, it's time for fun questions.
I'm game for anything. Really quickly, I would like to say, Simon, the sash maker is Lisa Gandry. And so I want to give her due credit. I do not want to leave her name out, and very, very indebted to her.
All right. Sorry, I had one more question I forgot to ask you. I'm so silly. Go. I should write these down. See, I write notes on the movies, so I forget some of my questions sometimes.
Absolutely.
Where have you taken the film? Have you taken the film festivals? Have you submitted to the film festivals? What have you done with it?
I really did it bass backwards. you know, the standard approach is you make your film, you release it to film festivals, you generate buzz. From the buzz, the distributors pick it up, and then it goes out to, you know, the various platforms and things.
Sure.
But what I did, I was very pragmatic with the type of movie that this was. It's really a mass audience kind of movie. It's not a niche film. It's not a film festival film. So I was like, to me, it needs to be on the broadest platforms first and kind of go backwards from there. So, released it in a couple of theaters first, and approached distributors, and I got a lot of interest. Ultimately, I decided to self-distribute it. I put it on Amazon myself because I really wanted to learn, you know, what do filmmakers really earn by putting it on these platforms themselves. So I wanted that to be part of this learning experience. And now am I going to the festival circuit. And in fact, we're accepted to a festival in Mobile, Alabama, April the 6th and 7th, I believe. And we've got about 2 or 3 more that we are up for consideration for.
Yeah, you definitely did it ass backwards. Usually it goes the other way. So you said you showed this film in theaters. Were they local cinema or was it just somewhere else that you wouldn't think it would have been shown?
Yes, they were independently owned theaters along the Mississippi Gulf Coast because the big theater chains, they don't want to do business with independent filmmakers. You know, if you're not part of a distribution company that they're contracted with, then they're not going to give you the time of day. So you really have to find a theater that's kind of, you know, owned by mom and pop and is welcoming enough for you to show your film there. And so that's what we did.
Okay, great. Okay, now we're finally officially to fun questions. Don't worry, I promise.
All right.
Favorite film?
Favorite film? Oh, I think I would probably have to say Thief by Michael Mann, starring James Caan.
Oh, wow. Actually, you're one of the few people that's named something I haven't seen. It's on my list forever.
Well, you have – have you seen the movie Drive yet?
I have seen Drive.
Okay. So once you see Thief, you're going to see that Drive is a homage to that film.
Okay. A buddy of mine loves Thief, so he's always on me going, you haven't watched Thief? I'm like, I'll get to it.
It's amazing. Amazing.
Okay, it's Friday night. There's people at your house. Your buddies are over. They want to watch a movie. What's it going to be?
Oh, are we having? Are we planning to have fun here?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we are watching Staying Alive because I know every word to that movie.
Oh my god,
that is a super fun movie.
Wow. What a weird choice. Staying Alive. Your friends might kill you. Yeah. I know that.
That's one of the most fun movies you're ever going to watch. So.
Wow, staying alive. That's kind of fun. Well, the last one's really easy. You're at the concession stand. What do you buy?
Oh, I'm probably going to have to buy something like Goobers or something like that. Something chocolate covered.
I have to ask you, what's a Goober? Is that a chocolate covered raisin?
Raisinettes would probably be.
Okay, I know what a raisinette is. Okay, good. Because we don't have Goobers, so I apologize. Someone's like, what? My last question is, or really, tell everybody where they can find your film.
Right now, the primary place that you can find the film is on Amazon, and we just went to Prime as of this month, February, because I thought that would be a great month to move to make that transition, Valentine's Day and whatnot. And it's on track to make even more, and that's a whole discussion in itself, but to do even better than when we initially put it on Amazon for rent and purchase. So that's been really, really cool. But Amazon Prime is the primary place you're going to find it. Just moved to a few minor platforms. I think Fandango Now just requested it. I think Vimeo is another new platform that we're on.
Fandango but that's shows gonna films?
Fandango Now. So apparently it's kind of their subscription video or maybe.
You're the first I've ever heard of Fandango Now out of anybody.
And it went to chaos. Kind of okay. I didn't realize that was even an option. But yeah, so I'm familiar with Fandango. So I said, sure.
Oh, wow. Fascinating. Well, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for sending me your film and hope everything works out well for you.
Well, I appreciate you allowing me on and talking with me and giving us some free publicity. And it was a lot of fun. And I appreciate you and your show. And I hope everyone gives our film a chance. We're a micro budget film. We're like Rocky. We're kind of an underdog. But give us a chance. And I think you'll see some great performances and great story and have a pretty good time.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. Have a great night.
Thanks, Simon. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.